Welcome to Issues and Ideas. Coming up on today's program, an estimated 10 to 40 million parrots live in the United States as pets. Because captive-bred parrots are just a few generations from their wild cousins, owners often misunderstand their needs. Donna Cheek and local parrot rescuer Marty Johnson explore the challenges that face these beautiful and intelligent birds. Plus, Brian Reynolds visits with longtime bookstore owner Carol Leslie of Volumes of Pleasure Bookstore in Los Osos, and with new bookstore owner Darren Gabler of The Bookworm in Santa Maria. They discuss the wonders and treasures of our local bookstores and their continuing changes. But up first, correspondent Tom Wilmer visits with the owners of Olea Farm in Templeton to learn about California's distinctive olive oils. We'll learn what the term extra virgin first press really means and what some of the differences are between European and California olive oils.
Olive oil has been an integral part of the culinary experience of Europeans for thousands of years. But here in California, olive oil production has just started to blossom within the last decade. I'm Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me in Templeton, California, as we visit with Hotel and Eve Julian, the owners of Olea Farm in Templeton, California, where we'll learn exactly what first press extra virgin olive oil actually means. We'll talk about government regulations in Europe versus America, the antioxidant benefits, cooking with olive oil, and the different varieties. Clotilde and Eve Julian. How many trees do you have?
So we have 1,200 trees here on the property, but we also have ranches where we purchase fruit local. We do bottling, we do everything involved in the olive oil. We do the milling. We are co-owners of a mill on wheels, which is a mobile processing olive mill. Everything from start to finish in the olive oil.
The mill is an expensive proposition, and that's one reason why you have one and other people don't. You go to them and mill their harvest.
Owning a mill is a great expense for a tool that's only going to be working at the best 3 months a year. We go from orchard to orchard as the fruit comes off the tree, goes into the mill, less than 2 hours approximately. The olive oil is going to be coming out, so the olive oil is going to be extremely fresh.
Much unlike fine red wine, you do not want to put your olive oil away and put it in a library. You want to use it right away.
Yes. It's about a 2-year shelf life.
Doesn't get better.
No, it doesn't get better.
How does the consumer know when one goes to the grocery store how fresh the olive oil is they see on the shelf?
Usually what happens on a good olive oil should be written the harvest date. So knowing the harvest date, you know that a good olive oil has a 2-year shelf life, then you know if the oil is fresh or not fresh. The main problem are going to be the oils coming from overseas, from Europe or North Africa. That's where it may be a little tricky to find a good olive oil.
Is that because there is no government regulations on what is in the olive oil bottle?
There is some regulation, but the regulation in North Africa are going to be different than the regulation in Europe. Let's take an example from an olive oil coming from Europe. Let's say on the label you are going to see extra virgin olive oil. Well, in Europe you can put on your label extra virgin olive oil even though it's not 100% extra virgin olive oil.
Is there a minimal percentage?
Not really. We heard it was about 25 to 30% extra virgin olive oil. It means that there is 70% of crappy something else.
Everybody talks about, we all see on the label, extra virgin olive oil. What does that mean?
If you see extra virgin olive oil from an oil from California or from United States, you know that it's 100% extra virgin.
Is that first press only?
It's first cold press, meaning that you get the fruit, crush them, work the paste for about 30, 45 minutes. You are allowed to heat the paste up to 25 degrees centigrade. That's the regulation for 100% extra virgin olive oil. And then you centrifuge the paste and get the juice. The olive oil should be the juice of the fruit, and that's the best olive oil that you can get.
What is the junk filler stuff you were talking about that they add to supposedly extra virgin?
It can be something else than olive oil. It can be pomace oil, it can be canola oil, or what they also do, they heat the paste. And when they heat the paste of the olives, then you get more juice. But the quality of the juice is not the same. All the polyphenols are gone, all the good stuff is gone, and there is almost no more antioxidant. So what you want to do to make a good olive oil, you want to first cold press. You press the fruit, you don't heat the paste, get the juice, and you don't add any solvent, you don't add anything else. Just get the juice of the fruit.
In America, in California, what do people know? What can they expect without having to guess?
The rules that we have in California is if you make olive oil, they're very strict. It can only be 100% extra virgin. We're not allowed to do anything else, and I think that's very important because everybody has the same quality olive oil, so whether you buy a California Central Coast or if you buy from another area, you know California olive oil rules are 100% extra virgin. And with that olive oil, you can cook and bring it up to high temperatures. You can make French fries. That's something that we do as part of education. We have people come and we do French fries, deep fried French fries in olive oil, and people can taste and see for themselves that the olive oil is not burning and we're making very good French fries.
And you're talking to 400 to 500 degrees Fahrenheit?
Maybe not 500, but the French fries are at 365, something like that. Pretty much you can go up to 400 degrees with the olive oil, but there's nothing much that you cook at that temperature anyway. But at least you have a good quality olive oil. It makes your French fries, as odd as it may seem, or any vegetable, it coats the outside and makes it nice and crispy. And inside you have the texture of the potato, which is definitely much nicer than biting into a French fry and having a bunch of oil grease coming out into your mouth all over. That's really pretty disgusting.
Let's dig a little deeper on cooking with olive oil. There's a lot of misconceptions. Some people say, I can't cook with olive oil because it smokes and it burns. So that's an obvious example of a non-extra virgin?
Yes, so a non-extra virgin olive oil is going to burn at a low temperature. Unfortunately, most of the education that's been going around, people say that they can't cook with extra virgin olive oil because it burns at a low temperature. But if it is 100% extra virgin, it's not a problem. We have a lot of our local chefs and restaurants that are using our olive oils and that are very conscious and very aware that they can cook and bring it up and saute, fry, you name it, they can do it. You can do pastry with olive oil.
Let's talk a little bit. She was talking about arbequina. There are different types of berries making different types of olive oil. Tell us about the different types that somebody would find and why you would choose what.
Well, you can compare a good olive oil to good wines. A Merlot is going to be different than a Cab, and Arbequina is going to be different than a Coronecchi, or an Arbosana is going to be different than a Tuscan olive, than Sevillano, Mission. There is about 1,000 different varietals of trees, and they all have their different qualities and different tastes. Depends on what you like.
Talk for a moment about your two or three most popular olive oils.
So the first one is going to be the European style. I call it European style because we like to do a late harvest. It's going to make an oil very mild and very fruity. We like to use this oil to do any kind of salad dressing because it's so fruity that even if you add vinegar or mustard to make your salad dressing, you are still going to have the nice fruitiness of the taste of the olive oil. Then we have the Frantoio. The Frantoio, for example, it's Tuscan tree, and the Frantoio is going to be more grassy, more bitter, more pungent, and we really like the Frantoio. It's a very generous olive oil, and we like it on winter dishes like pasta, seafood. Then we are going to go with the Spanish one, like the Arbequina, for example. The Arbequina, fresh-cut grass taste. Arbequina, it's a spring in your mouth. Arbequina is going to be very delicate oil, very nice balance, a little fruitiness, a little pungency, a little bitterness, and a nice nutty aftertaste. Arbequina, you can use it on everything. You can drink it. It's such a wonderful oil. Arbequina on baked potato, arbequina on mashed potato, arbequina on a nice tomato salad, feta cheese, sea salt. Are you hungry now?
Yes. It's working.
It's working good.
You were talking earlier about olive oil, ideally, and again, it's preference, but not dominating, bringing out the flavors of the food rather than the olive oil itself.
I think that's very important because when you're eating food, it's like wine. You want everything to go together. You don't want something overpowering something else. So we were talking earlier before we were doing this interview, talking about a grilled steak. When you have a lot of things that are added to the steaks, like the peppercorns and all those, you don't really get the taste of the meat. So with the olive oil, you want to do the same thing. You want to use your olive oil to help cook your food and bring some nice flavors to it, but you don't want it to overpower. Like if you're eating a tomato salad or something like that, you don't want to be eating olive oil with tomatoes. You want the tomatoes and the olive oil to go together and bring in nice flavors. And like a tomato salad with the arbequina, like Eve was saying, it's an easy dish, extremely healthy. You have your tomato salad, you make it, you put your olive oil on it, you put the sea salt, you put it aside, you cook your rice when it's hot, you put your tomatoes with a little bit of the olive oil that's in the bottom of the dish on it, and it's just an amazing feel because you get the taste of the tomatoes with the olive oil, the rice. It's just really nice and simple and healthy.
Speaking of healthy, let's talk specifically for a moment about the health benefits of olive oil, which there are many.
Well, the main thing with the olive oil are going to be the polyphenols. All the polyphenols are coming from when you are milling the olives. You don't want to add any water. You don't want to add any heat. So when you are extracting the oil, you are just extracting the oil and trying to keep all the polyphenols into the oil. So if you add water, then you are separating the oil from the water, and the water is going to wash out the polyphenols. So let's start with a good olive oil full of polyphenols. That's the antioxidant. That's where the shelf life is. So the benefits are just wonderful. Olive oil is bad cholesterol free. Olive oil is supposed to prevent coronary.
Coronary heart disease, and that's certified by the FDA. It's very important, yes, with the cholesterol. It brings up the good cholesterol, brings down the bad cholesterol. It's just very healthy for your skin. Also, there's working information about helping with Alzheimer's and with cancer. Of course, all of these things are really important for people to use so that they get the good health benefits out of it.
So we should drink a shot every day then?
Pretty much. 2 tablespoons a day is given to prevent coronary heart disease. But you can use olive oil at breakfast on a muffin. Use it also on a bagel. Just drizzle a little bit of olive oil, some honey or jam. You'll see it's absolutely wonderful. Then you use it at lunch and you use it at dinner. You don't need any other fat in your house.
Can you think of a negative of olive oil?
No. Yes, there is something negative about olive oil, which is very interesting, is when you have it on your countertop, you have to be careful because when it's granite, extra virgin olive oil only is going to make little marks on your countertop. I learned that the hard way.
Interesting. Okay, let's say I'm at a grocery store and I'm looking for an olive oil and all I find are European labels. How do I know what I'm getting?
You don't.
It doesn't matter whether it's France or Spain or anywhere.
It doesn't matter. You don't have the information. You don't know when it's been harvested most of the time. And you don't know how long it's been traveling, how it's been stored. You don't have anything on the label that indicates where it's been and what has happened to the olive oil. California olive oil, for the moment, it's still fairly new. Most of the growers are selling their olive oil here in California. From our farm, we ship to a lot of customers all over the United States. But we don't have our olive oil in stores all over the United States. We have several stores in Los Angeles and things like that, but California olive oil doesn't go anywhere, so you know that it's going to be really fresh. It's of the year for the majority, I would say for everybody, because we run out at the end of the season, so it's just a very fresh product, and you can be sure with California olive oil that you're going to get a good product.
In the last 10 years, there has been a literal explosion in the growth of planting of trees and harvesting and processing. Tell us about the state of the California olive oil world.
Yes, more and more trees have been planted over the last 10 years. We plant a lot of orchards in the North County of San Luis Obispo, and in the last 4 years, I want to say we've planted about maybe somewhere around 85,000 trees, and little by little, they're starting to come into production. We still have a long ways to go because the United States still imports, I would say, approximately 96% of its olive oil from Europe. So that is something that needs to be worked on. People, once they've come and they've tasted and they have the experience with the olive oil, it's really not difficult to get them to change their habits. The flavors are just so different, and the freshness and the experience, really, they just like it.
Thank you guys so much for visiting. What a wonderful morning.
The new olive oil, it's California and not Europe anymore. And don't forget,
don't depend on foreign oil.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Olea Farms in Templeton, California.
This is Issues and Ideas. To hear an extended interview about olive oil with the Julians and to see a picture, visit our Facebook page at KCBX-FM. Still to come on today's program, Brian Reynolds visits with two bookstore owners to discuss the wonders, treasures, and continuing changes of our local bookstores. But up first, Donna Cheek and local parrot rescuer Marty Johnson explore the challenges that face these beautiful and intelligent birds.
I'm Donna Cheek with Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. Today, my guest is Marty Johnson and his parrot that you will hear in the background, Kiwi. And Marty Johnson is a local dog training expert and owner of Ragin' Kennels. Thank you, Marty, for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Donna.
I've known you for many years now as a very talented dog trainer. In fact, you trained my dog, but you're not here today to talk about dogs. There's another animal that you have grown to love. I do believe our listeners have heard her in the background. Tell me about Kiwi and how the two of you met.
Parrots have always had a big interest for me as I learned about parrot rescue and the needs of parrots that didn't have homes, who have outlived their owners. Found a group in Northern California called Mikaboo, mikaboo.org, and that's how I found Kiwi, who keeps me company every day.
Parrot, from what I understand, covers a multitude of breeds, like if you were to say terrier. And so you have different kinds of terrier dogs, and then you have different kinds of parrots.
There's lots of different species of parrots. They all have their own personalities. I was looking for a bird that could talk a lot. I was looking at either Amazons or African Greys. And the personality of an Amazon would be like a comedian.
Once you realized that you wanted to get a bird, then you decided on the kind of bird you want, and then what?
Through Mikaboo, they have a whole educational program that you have to go through. I had to do like a 4-hour phone interview, and then they did a home check to make sure everything was safe.
With regards to Mikaboo, and Mikaboo is a 501c3 nonprofit, and they rescue parrots, and then they place them with foster care and also rehome them.
Yes.
Getting a parrot is not a simple process because you mentioned you had an interview.
The phone wasn't actually an interview. It was more of an educational class.
Oh.
Giving you all the information that you're going to need to become a parrot's person, to take care of them.
A parrot's person.
Yeah. Like needing 12 hours of sleep a day because they go to bed at sundown and they wake up at sunrise. And a lot of parrot owners, their parrots are up till 10, 11, 12 at night, just like they are. So there's just a lot of education. I had to get rid of all my pots and pans. I had to do a lot of changes within my house because those chemicals are poisonous to parrots.
Because Kiwi gets out and about and she might land on a pan?
It's the cooking fumes.
Okay. I remember you mentioning to me that it was kind of like Match.com, where you look on the website and you're looking for the bird that you think would fit your lifestyle and to be your mate.
Yeah, and that's a lot of the fun of it. They have so many different species of birds that you can choose from that it's really interesting. You can go to, you look at the Amazons, the African Greys, they've got the macaws, the cockatoos. And a lot of these birds have outlived their owners, so they're not just birds that got dumped off. They've had a great life. They have this great vocabulary. They've been trained really well, so it's not like starting from scratch. You actually read all about this bird, what it does, and then you actually go and meet the bird.
Was Kiwi the only bird that you met?
Yes, she was.
How was the first meeting? Was it love at first sight?
Absolutely. Hi, Kiwi.
Kiwi's like, you better say that. You and Kiwi have been together for how long now?
It'll be 2 years in March.
Okay. Oh, thank you, Kiwi. I watched a program on PBS, and this program about parrots was informative, but so heartbreaking. There were so many things about parrots that I wasn't aware of. And one of the things that I learned is that parrots are all considered wild. And they're considered wild because, unlike dogs, they have not been domesticated for thousands of years. Captive bred parrots are just a few generations from their wild cousins. Now, with that said, how does that translate into some behavior that you've seen in Kiwi?
You have to be careful, like bring her into this studio. I've never actually had her out in public, and I can handle her all that I want to at home. Bringing her into a new situation, she could bite me just out of the excitement of what's going on.
The biting part can be pretty serious.
Yeah, and like you saw in the program, also parrots can be very much one-person birds.
Yes.
They can, like, one person in the family and not like anybody else.
They're smart, aren't they? The program was talking about how large their brain is.
Right.
And how they have sophisticated emotions. For instance, there was a bird by the name of Basil. And Basil plucked his own feathers out. They were talking about how self-mutilation is an emotional response and issue, just like cutting would be for a teenager. And I had no idea they could be that emotional.
Right. I knew that as potential adopter, foster adopter of a parrot, because I train dogs and I work at home, that I could give Kiwi constant attention. I'm always home. I'm not gone for more than 2-3 hours at a time. She has her inside life, her cage inside the house. She has her outside life. I have a large macaw cage for her outside. Mm-hmm. So she gets to enjoy her days in the sunshine. And if she was just a parrot that was just locked up, then if she were to become upset, then she could start to self-mutilate.
Oh my goodness. It was heartbreaking. And I think that a lot of people underestimate the commitment that is necessary to have a bird in their lives.
As a person that's going to have a parrot, you want to be able to give them the time. Kiwi keeps me company. She's a part of my life. When I go to town for any length of time, she can go with me. If it's a rainy day, rather than leave her in the house, we'll load up in the truck and she'll go with me. And they say a parrot has the mentality of like a 2 or 3 year old. It does takes a lot of attention with them.
To do it right.
Right.
To do it right.
To give them a good life.
So that you have a happy bird and not a bird that is alone. Because they were also saying that in the wild, parrots are never alone. Because they have these long relationships.
Right.
I'm Donna Cheek with Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. We are talking with Marty Johnson, a local dog training expert and owner of Ragin' Kennels, but not about dogs. We are discussing the plight of parrots in the U.S. and more importantly, here on the Central Coast and what we can do to help with this problem. Okay, I want to talk about why parrots are surrendered. What are some of the reasons that you know of?
One of them, and in Kiwi's case, she outlived her owner. Parrots will live 50 to 60 years, and if you're like me, 50 when you get one, Kiwi's 17 right now, I'm going to be searching for the right person that when I go, that Kiwi has a great home. So that's a big part of it. Another is maybe the novelty of getting a parrot and then realizing how much work it is, and so that would be a surrender issue. Or just getting bored with it, that becomes a surrender issue. The economy, when people lose their homes. I think even in that TV program, there was the empty house with the parrot in it.
Lou.
Yeah, they
Lou
walked,
was
walked
abandoned.
Right out of the house, left the parrot inside the house.
And the thing about it, the feeling that I got is that parrots are so intelligent, Lou was aware of the abandonment. He knew his family left and never came back, and that was an issue for him.
Absolutely.
As a matter of fact, there was another parrot that they talked about, and this parrot, his name was Fagin, and Fagin was addicted to nicotine because he lived in a household where there was a smoker.
Right.
And he had to detox.
Yeah, how sad. And that's one of the things that Mikaboo makes sure of, is that there is not a smoker in the house.
You initially were just fostering Kiwi to see how it would go?
I went into it to adopt, and they said, why don't you just foster her first?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, that's fine. If I'm fostering a bird and there's any veterinary needs, Mikaboo pays those veterinary needs.
That's
anything
nice.
That the parrot might need is supplied by Mikaboo. You can foster an Amazon, and then it finds a home. Then you can get an African Grey, and then it gets a home. And then you get this bird, and you don't want anybody to take it away from you, and then you adopt. So with Kiwi, I just didn't want anybody to even come look at her.
And there you have it, because Kiwi was yours.
I was keeping Kiwi.
This can be a really good alternative to a dog. In our conversation, you said that a parrot is like a dog that can talk.
Absolutely. She is so entertaining because Kiwi just makes everybody smile and laugh. Kiwi just does the goofiest things.
Yes. That's really good for people to know because some people aren't active and, you know, they might be allergic to a dog, whereas they could have the benefits of a talking dog with feathers.
Right. Her and I, we have this amazing relationship and I can do just anything with her, pick her up anytime I want to, hold her on her back, whatever. She can go underneath the covers with me, rides around on my shoulders, gives me kisses, sits on top of my head while I drink my coffee in the morning.
Wow.
She's just, yeah.
She does
great,
all of
great
that
company.
And can talk to you.
And can talk.
She calls you. You're on your ranch working with the dogs and then she calls you?
Yeah. I say, Marty. I go, what?
Oh, that is cute. What would you like to see happen here on the Central Coast with parrots?
Well, mainly just making people aware that there is such an organization, mikaboo.org, and that there is the need that these birds are out there that need forever homes. And if there was enough interest on the Central Coast that was contacting Mikaboo, then they would need people here locally that could do the home inspections, that could teach the classes.
Is that something that you may want to do for them as far as assist with the link of that organization to this area?
Sure, I would.
And I want our listeners to understand that what Mikaboo needs is foster homes for these parrots. And it's not a indefinite commitment. It could be a short-term commitment for them to just experience what it's like to have a bird.
Right.
There are sanctuaries that are just busting at the seams with birds in every room of the house.
Right.
Because there's not enough people who consider them as a pet. And I must say, I never understood and realized how lovable and how satisfying a relationship with a bird could be.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
And we have a mutual friend in Indiana that is an animal lover, trains dogs, has a cat. She has a bird.
She was scared to death of birds when she first came to work for me.
Yes.
And then back home in Indiana while she was out with her dogs, this cockatiel flew down and landed on her shoulder and scared her to death.
Yes.
She took it to the local vet or the local shelter. And then in the very end, she said, oh, I'll take it. And now she loves it.
There's two examples right here in my life where there's dog lovers who transition.
Yeah.
They transition and become bird lovers.
Right.
I wanted to focus today on your relationship with Kiwi and how as a prominent dog trainer in this area, you have grown to appreciate the relationship that you can have with a parrot.
Yes. The joy of giving a parrot a home and spending time with it day in and day out. Actually, it's more amazing what they give back to you. When Kiwi gets to chattering and talking and I'm out watering the plants and she's just going on and on and on and on, and it's just, it makes around my house sound happy, and it's just really neat
with her little voice.
Yeah.
That's really special.
Yeah.
We took pictures of Kiwi for the Facebook page. If listeners want to see Kiwi and make a comment, or if they have a question, they can post a question on the KCBX Facebook page. Take a look at Kiwi and like her.
Absolutely.
Marty, I want to thank you so much for coming in and talking with me today and sharing your knowledge and experience with us about Kiwi.
And we thank you. And Kiwi's been a very good girl. And she was quite noisy when we first got her in here. And she quieted down so that we could do this.
She did. She's been such a good girl.
Yeah.
I'm Donna Cheek with Issues and Ideas.
This is Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX. And as Donna Cheek mentioned, to see a picture of Kiwi the parrot, you can visit our Facebook page at KCBX FM. Still to come on Issues and Ideas today, Brian Reynolds visits with two bookstore owners to discuss the wonders, treasures, and continuing changes of our local bookstores. Support for KCBX comes from Studios on the Park, the nonprofit Open Studios Arts Center in downtown Paso Robles. You can experience the creative process with professional artists like Drew Davis, Rod Asman, and John Partridge working in oil and watercolor. Details are online at studiosonthepark.org. Coming up at 2 o'clock, which is in just about a half hour, it's On Being. Parallel realities and the deep structure of space-time sound like science fiction, but these are matters of real scientific inquiry. Lord Martin Rees is a cosmologist and astrophysicist who spends his life contemplating such things. He insists that we ourselves, human beings, are the most complex cosmic phenomena. Though, as he tells Krista Tippett, we are probably not the apex of evolution. That's On Being, coming up at 2 o'clock today here on KCBX. Now, Issues and Ideas continues.
Hello, this is Brian Reynolds, volunteer with the San Luis Obispo County Library for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Today, we are joined by Carol Leslie of the Volumes of Pleasure Bookshop in Los Osos and Darren Gabler, owner of The Bookworm, an independent bookstore in Santa Maria. Welcome.
Thank you.
I have to start off this conversation. Why would anybody, and I'll take an answer from either or both of you, start a bookstore, an independent bookstore in this day and age?
I should let Darren go first because we've had the Volumes of Pleasure for 22 years, so let him weigh in on that.
Yeah, because we just took over last year. part of it for us is that we were customers there. My companion and I were customers there, so we knew what was good about it. We knew the owner. We liked going there, and when it looked like she was, the former owner was going to retire, we didn't want to see the store go anywhere, and I was looking to change careers, and books is one of the things that we loved because we're kind of media junkies, and so we just started talking about it, and over the course of a couple of months, it just kind of started to fall together.
It's interesting that you would say media, because I'm sure when people think of media, they think of something more dynamic like TV, radio, or even the internet. Carol, you why do you stay in business?
Oh, Brian, that's a tough question. We bought the bookstore in 92, so we're looking at 22 years of being there. And in those 22 years, the book business has changed, as you know, dramatically. So I think a love of books from the time I was very, very small is just, and I'm kind of stubborn, and I like it that people appreciate what we're trying to do there and tell us every day, I'm so glad you're there. So that's what keeps us going, certainly not the bottom line.
I've looked at and read about various businesses, and I know that certain businesses have a razor-thin profit margin, restaurants, hospitals, but bookstores have got to be pretty close to that. You mentioned some changes, and I would like to hear from both of you. What do you think you, either as a customer or as a longtime owner, the changes you've seen either in running the business or society's reading habits, et cetera?
It seems to me that in the intervening 22 years, people seem to be reading less. They're watching more television. And, of course, we live in a beautiful county with such beautiful things to see that people are very outdoorsy. I think the concentration, the attention span is kind of limited. And, you know, you really make a commitment when you buy a book and put yourself into a book. So I think that's really changed dramatically. And I think up until we have such a terrible concentration of publishing in this country that it really has affected the independent bookstores. And I think that Howard Zinn once said that the independent bookstores are the lifeblood of a democracy, and without them, our democracy is threatened. So the biggest concern I have is that what we read is in the hands of smaller and smaller groups, and that's not healthy for a democracy.
Yeah, understood. How about you, Darren, as a consumer, as a reader, and now a new bookstore owner, what changes have you seen?
Well, what actually, for the store, and this has been evident just as a customer, but it kind of leads from what you were saying, since there's smaller and smaller groups as customers, it also means that the bookstores can't really be, depending on the community you're in, can't be specialty bookstores as much as they were. We were just talking about it a few minutes ago. It seems like if you're a bookstore, even if you're very small like we are, you've got to have a little bit of everything to serve those smaller groups. And so there's more to watch out for. Carol ran a more of a specialty shop some years ago, and obviously your job must have changed a little bit once you took over the larger shop with multiple varieties in it, because when you're watching your stock, you have a lot of categories to look in, and there's a lot of titles to keep up with. What's new? What's coming out? What are people looking for?
And I think Americans have become more in love with technology, and so they love the e-books and that kind of thing. And it's like the latest toy, the toy that people have. I envision one day after I'm gone that people will be sitting around a table very much like this, and there will be only e-readers or something like that, and somebody will say, you know what would be great is if we actually printed those words on a page and bound them in something, and then people could hold it and read it. And, you know, it sounds like something out of the Twilight Zone, but I think that could be.
You know, I was thinking about your comment of attention span, and I know enough from my career and being a reader, lifelong reader, that when human beings became literate, that is, when you had a written alphabet and material created in written down as opposed to an oral culture, you really moved from a culture that was depending on memory and the spoken word, things in real time, things that could be remembered or discussed, say, around a campfire or in a group, to things that were about memory. And clearly, when things get very long, you have to be able to remember things that are longer. And so I'm convinced that when the novel came along in the 1700s, probably our brains adjusted a little bit to be able to handle a longer story and more complicated maybe plot or characters. But you mentioned attention span. I think where a lot of your stimulation every day is instant or brief, that your brains get used to that, and maybe it's like your muscles don't get as limber or strong as they were, your mental muscles, and maybe people are going to be incapable of a longer narrative or even thinking about issues that are complicated. What do you think about that?
Well, I suppose that could be, but I also think it's, it's a cultural thing. While you were saying that, I was kind of thinking of photography as well. Before there was photography to document things, a couple centuries ago, everybody knew how to draw because that's how you documented what it was that you were seeing. That skill, yes, it did, as a cultural norm, it started to decrease, but plenty of people still do it.
Right.
Some people still do it even as a means of documentation. It just kind of has an artistic
bent to it. Yeah, not so much as a way to live.
Right, right.
I had a wonderful experience with my youngest sister. She grew up with television, and I didn't. She's 15 years younger. And so she came to live with me when she graduated from high school, and we went out to see mother and the family. And then the way back, I had the radio on, and there was a story, and there was the Lone Ranger, or there was a mystery story on. I said, let's listen to this. And after we did, she said, this is really good. I can make pictures in my head. I don't need the television. Here I am. I'm seeing all this. And, you know, she became a better reader after that. But she really got that there was more to life than television.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's something about the human mind and spirit that I've always thought about is critical, and it could be that other creatures have it, but humans do for sure, and that is we have an imagination, we dream, and it's a healthy thing, both night dreaming and daydreaming. They say if you don't dream, you might become mentally ill. And so I have read, and I certainly believe, that there's two kinds of artworks that are inherently incomplete until you participate in them, and then they elicit the imagination big time. One would be radio, especially narrative or old-time radio, like comedies or mysteries, and books.
Yes.
That not only are they an incomplete and then they become complete, but they literally draw you in and they stimulate what I call the imagining nerve, which has got to be a healthy thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The idea of time. You mentioned people don't have time. What do you think about the investment that a person should be making in their day? Should it be time spent with others or time spent with a device? How do you see that?
Well, I think that people, especially since the economy took a dump in 2008, people seem to be working longer hours and have less leisure time. In fact, there's a study recently that showed that we have one-third less free time than we did 25 years ago. And so I think that's a factor.
That's a huge number.
It is a huge number. It is a huge number. And you need that time in order to sit down. I have a friend of mine who, he's busy, he works, et cetera, and he gets up at 4 in the morning because he loves to read, and so from 4 to 6, he reads. And then he gets ready for work and goes to work. So he's making time.
But they have to see the, people have to give things like that a shot to see what they can get from it. You don't always know just from talking about it or hearing about it from somebody else. Books are that way. I think music is that way, too. When you sit down with a book, sometimes you don't know, even if you know what the story is, you don't really know what effect it's going to have on you. And that, and books are especially this way. When you spend what you think is 5 minutes reading it, it turns out you've been reading it for half an hour. You've just been taking in all this information and not realizing how much it was affecting you. So it doesn't take as much to make that commitment as we might think it does in our abstract thinking.
You know, two commodities that I think are both scarce in modern life. We mentioned one of them, time, but also solitude without interruptions. I think if you're, studies have shown if you're reading a good book or a good story, you're absorbed in it, and someone can speak in your ear from maybe 6 inches away, and physiologically your eardrum is vibrating, but your brain is not processing it, which gives the lie, in my mind, to multitasking. You might be able to multitask when things don't require thought, like you can whistle and drive your car, but I don't think you can engage in something meaningful or absorbing two things at once. I mean, maybe some people can, but I doubt that many people could do it.
Yeah, and I think in our grandparents and parents' generation, nobody talked about multitasking, but they do today, and there's all kinds of studies indicating that there's no such thing. It supports what you were saying.
It's a myth.
It's a myth.
For a research paper I was writing, I was reading the works of a so-called urban anthropologist, and this lady studies urban cultures, like as opposed to primitive cultures, and she said that the amount of data we had to absorb from a mere 500 years ago, like our ancestors of Shakespeare's time, we could probably get along with them. They might smell bad or have bad teeth, but we certainly could get along with them and understand their worldviews and so forth. 500 years isn't so much. Anyways, the number of stimuli that we face every day had increased, according to her, 400 times that. You can imagine your great-grandfather, say, in Shakespeare's time, waking up and wondering what he was going to eat for breakfast or what the weather was like. Today, we're hearing news from around the world, and the stock market is doing this, and clearly, to me, we have way too much stimulation going on, which is one reason I see books and reading is actually a salutary thing, an antidote for too much information or for what's called hurry sickness.
Absolutely. Mm. And it's interesting you mentioned Shakespeare, because I tell people, whoever will listen when I get their attention, that if they want to know everything about human nature, even human nature today, all they have to do is read Shakespeare, Steinbeck, and Mark Twain, and you'll have all the nuances of human behavior all down. Yeah.
I think that's true. That's why all those guys are still in print. People still come into the
shop
looking for them.
Yeah.
They read a few words, and they know they have to read more.
Well, that's probably a definition of a classic. Classic anything is something which you can go back to over the years, remains popular, remains relevant and timely. This is Brian Reynolds, San Luis Obispo County Library volunteer for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Carol Leslie, owner of Volumes of Pleasure Bookshop in Los Osos, California, and Darren Gabler, owner of The Bookworm in Santa Maria. What is the nuance or the distinction between a new bookstore and a used bookstore, or one that has both? I know that San Luis Obispo, I don't think it has a new independent bookstore anymore, but rather, or a bookstore that sells new books that's independent. But they do have some used bookstores like Leon's. What it would be the distinction there?
Well, we're actually kind of, because you sell a lot more new stuff.
Yeah. Now, Coalesce combines them. They combine used and new. In fact, they have more used than they do new.
That's kind of what we do.
Yeah. And we never looked at the used book market, because until last year, we had a used bookstore that we could go out our back door and point to, and we did a lot of that pointing back and forth, but it closed. And we haven't, we don't really have room to add the used bookstores. We do have large print that are used, because we have a certain clientele that need that.
Well, we have most of our stuff is used. I mean, well over 90% is used. I took over a used bookstore. It didn't have any new material. Maybe one or two things. The former owner, when she first opened it, she had competition from the B. Dalton and Walden Books and that sort of thing. That went away, obviously, a few years ago. Santa Maria hasn't had them there for quite a while, but she didn't want to. It's kind of like, it's almost like another business, the new stuff.
Exactly.
It affects how you handle trades. It affects, you know, it's a different thing. So she didn't really want to take that on. But that was one of the first things that we started to do within the last year.
And just to give you an indication, when we moved here in 1990, in San Luis County, there were 14 independent bookstores. And that's how the whole business and the books have changed. Bookstores have changed in just those few short years. We've seen it change dramatically. So really the only two new independent bookstores there are Coalesce in Morro Bay and us in Los Osos.
Two instead of 14.
Instead of 14.
Wow.
I know. San Luis alone had like four or five.
Yeah.
Maybe six.
And some really nice space. Actually, Leon's was a fantastic space out
there.
I
know. I love Leon's. Yeah.
You know, preparing for this show, I read some internet stories about bookstores and in some cases the demise of bookstores. And it seemed to me that one of the major arguments for not seeing that as a problem mm-hmm. was that the customer rules, customer demand rules, and customer demand could be defined or was narrowly defined in some of these articles as getting a good deal on a book, that is, getting a deeper discount on a book, or especially a new book, or maybe an obscure book. And I thought to myself, certainly there's more to a bookstore than, or to a book, than getting it at a good price, such as it isn't just commerce, it's more about culture and meeting a good friend and maybe having a cup of coffee over a book. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, well, you do need the book obviously is different from an e-book. A physical book is obviously different. I was even reading something recently where it affects how you take in information because it's physical. From my perspective, it just seems like we need to make sure we're doing a good job of showing off what it is that we have. And if you can show off how it's different, then to do that. Because in the end, like you're saying, the customer will have to choose to go to your store and spend time in your space. I think it's showing off the product a little bit. But I also think it's making sure that your store is a nice place to be, that it's a destination.
Exactly.
Place to hang.
Yeah, place to hang. And I think that two different people come in the bookstore, I found. People who know exactly what they want go tell you, well, I don't think you have it, but would you order it? And of course we will. And then the other one who is just kind of looking.
Yes.
And I asked them, what's the latest book you read that you enjoyed? And we have a great mystery section, so we sell a lot of mysteries in our store. But people like that hand selling. They like to know that you know the books, that you're connected with the books. Do you think books are important?
You can make suggestions.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
There's a professional specialty in librarianship called Reader's Advisory, and it's very difficult to do because it requires at least two things. One, that you like people and are comfortable talking with strangers, but also that you know the world of literature very well. And interestingly, it's not about promoting a book or a genre of books. It's about eliciting from that person, that reader, what they like or don't like, and then making some suggestions after the fact. And it's an art form, but it's a dialogue between two people.
That's
about
right.
Something they both think is important. And I think so much about the computers and the internet, a different kind of technology, I like to say, there's all kinds of technologies, including e or computer technologies, but there's chairs and tables and books and fireplaces. Those are all technologies. But a lot of the internet is a monologue. It's not a dialogue. Mm-hmm. It's the one person looking at data or content. And generally speaking, unless they're FaceTiming or Skyping, it's not a dialogue at all. It's I have to say, kind of lonely.
I felt that way as a consumer, too, before we owned a business, shopping online, we felt was that way, because usually when I go somewhere to buy something, nine times out of ten, I walk out there, whether it's a record store or a bookstore, with a stack of stuff that I didn't hear of before I walked in the door.
Exactly.
Harder to do online. The suggestions that get made to you are related to something that you're already looking for.
Well, internet, they call a homogenizer or aggregator. Their purpose is to look at your habits and show you things that are similar, right, not too dissimilar. And so I think it's almost the enemy of diversity in some sense.
I once said to my partner, because I grew up on physical books, loving them, taking care of them. I had a great aunt who was a school teacher, and you could never fold down pages, and she gave you this whole list of things of how you take care of a book. And so books are precious, and I said to Barbara one time, what is this? People don't see the book, they don't hold it, they don't leaf through it. What is the fascination with buying things online? And she said, it's because they can be sitting at their computer at 2 a.m. and they push a button and they've got it. And I know younger people, like early 30s and stuff, they buy everything online. It's just part of their mystique. Now, they do come in our store, I notice, and buy a few things here and there. But by and large, that's the way they shop.
I see both. I do have a nice group of young customers, mm-hmm, who are kind of the opposite, that don't really enjoy the online stuff too much. I have a lot of other customers that do both e-readers and physical book. You know, it has have their place.
We
as
do
well.
Too, especially if people are taking a long trip and they don't want to haul,
right,
and they're
sure.
avid readers. They don't want to haul half a dozen.
Right. And it certainly has its conveniences.
I want to talk a little bit about the idea of I think that there's a big difference between reading something online and reading a physical thing or being around physical books. There was a scientist I was reading, Theodore Roszak, one time, who said that the experience of looking at stuff, content, in a computer is totally different than being in a room with physical media, and a couple of important ways. When you're looking at a computer, you only see one screen at a time. It's like there's a hotel maybe with a billion rooms, but you only get to see one room at a time, and so it's a little disconcerting. I get giddy looking at video games because the point of the gun or the hero or whatever is always looking around a corner, and I get a little disoriented. But in a room full of physical items like books or maps or vinyl records or whatever, you have two things going on, Roszak says, that you don't have with a computer. One is you have a more real sense of the infinity of information, because it isn't just one screen. It's a whole room maybe full of thousands of items comprising millions of pages. And so you know in your own humble way you're never going to be able to get through all that stuff, and you can see it tangibly right around you by turning your head. But the other is human fallibility, where you know that even if you read all those books, you wouldn't remember it all, or you couldn't take notes that were reflective of their content. So being in a situation where you're looking at and interacting with physical media in a way is more nourishing or more grounding than being in a computer environment. At least that was his opinion.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I was mentioning before that there was reading an article recently that was suggesting that just taking in the information and being affected by it is better handled through physical means than just by looking at a screen.
And haven't there been some studies indicating that there's less retention?
Yeah, no, I think that was part of the, yeah. Yes, I think you're right.
Online, you know, a lot of the economic model of the internet is clicks. You click on this or you click on that, and there's a great book called The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Mind. Yeah. And if you read a paragraph of text that's just a straight narrative, you tend to retain more of it, but if it's interrupted with URLs to click on or even a glossary, you tend to remember a lot less than if it was just a straight story. I think human beings learn primarily in a story format, a beginning, a middle, and an end, with a rising tension in the middle. The prince meets the princess or whatever, and then the Wicked Witch comes in and it's resolved. But the internet is not a story. It's more like about, I don't mean to be slamming it, I'm addicted, as like anybody else, to the internet and YouTube in particular. But it's not a story. It's more like a jumble of that hotel with a billion rooms.
But something you said earlier about solitude, I think since we have one third less leisure time, we have a lot less solitude alone.
Sure.
And I think that Neil Postman wrote a book many years ago called "Amusing Ourselves to Death." And to me, that's what's all this distraction and stuff. It keeps us away from that solitude where we can develop ourselves and where we can read.
Interesting. Let's talk about the value and the unique value of independent businesses, independent bookstores. We know that we need and enjoy chain stores, chain restaurants. But what do independent bookstore owners bring to the table, to the community, that maybe a chain would not?
Mm. Well, one time I was talking to Barbara about restaurants. I said, why do people always, when they're traveling, they go to Taco Bell, McDonald's, et cetera? And she said, that's because of consistency.
Right.
And, that's something you really don't want in a bookstore. For example, you can walk into 10 different independent bookstores and see some main things, but you'd find a different lineup because of the interests of the bookseller. So there's a big variety, and I think we're lacking in variety when we do the cookie cutter.
Right. Now, there's influence in chain places. There's influence from people who have nothing to do with the actual location. In terms of what's stocked there and all that. Restaurants would be the same way in terms of what kind of food is there.
Like corporate headquarters.
Mm-hmm. That sort of thing. And for us, there's a personal relationship with customers, knowing what they like and bringing stuff in for them, knowing what kind of customers might show up that aren't regulars, people that come in out of town, knowing what sort of people come in that way. Chain stores, I don't think, respond as well to that sort of thing. But like you say, they have their place too. I certainly love them for some things. But yeah. The independent business, I think, offers a little more personal attention.
The not-so-famous Eudora Welty, who's a wonderful author, she once said that she loved traveling because people dress differently and things like that. She says, this monochromatic world that we've got today is so boring.
Mm.
Everybody has the same kind of shoes, the same kind of...
Right.
I thought it was an interesting observation for a writer to make.
I was a psychology major in college, and apparently you learn a lot more if you hang around people who are different from yourself, politically, ethnically, linguistically. You may not like it or agree with it, but you will be learning a lot more than if you're around people who are always part of your same clique or group. And probably a bookstore is especially like that, since it's really about ideas.
Right. Well, actually, yeah, related to that, there's some local authors that we're going to end up doing signings with. We've done some this year, and we'll do some next year. And they've all told me they tried with the bigger chain stores and couldn't get in because they weren't names. Hmm. They're not going to give time to that sort of author.
Interesting.
Sure. If you're John Grisham, they'll take you.
Exactly. Right. You've got to be
Jen Ivanovich, right, or Sue Grafton.
That's right.
Like that.
The number
yeah.
of customers that come
It is
in.
Harder and harder for new people to break into the
That's
field
right.
of literature.
Do self-published authors ever bring their wares to your door? And do you have to say yes
regularly.
Or no sometimes?
Regularly.
Oh, yes. We have an entire shelf devoted to local authors, pretty much Vanity Press.
Yeah, understood.
Yeah.
And a Vanity Press, for those of you that don't know, is a book that the author has invested the money in, either themselves or they paid somebody. The publisher's not paying them to do that. This has been Brian Reynolds, volunteer with the San Luis Obispo County Library, for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, our guests have been Carol Leslie, owner of Volumes of Pleasure Bookshop in Los Osos, California, and by Darren Gabler, owner of The Bookworm in Santa Maria. Thank you for joining me, and it's been a great discussion about books and independent bookstores.
And that does it for this week's Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX. Thank you for joining us. This is KCBX HD1 San Luis Obispo, KNBX HD1 San Ardo, and KSBX Santa Barbara. We are streaming live on the web at kcbx.org. Stay tuned next for On Being with Krista Tippett. Then at 3 o'clock, it's Fresh Air, followed by Marketplace at 4 o'clock. And at 4:30, it's All Things Considered from NPR News, here on KCBX.